Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Thank you, sir. 908. We're joined by Ron Bailey, professor and chair of psychiatry at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. Talk about mental health and a crisis in America, if it is a crisis. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Fine. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. Is there a mental health crisis in America?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any doubt. We've had this unfortunate perfect storm of a combination of not having enough resources to provide proactive preventative care up front. Many kids and schools have huge struggles. Society recognizes it, but we very often don't intervene until there's been a problem, behaviorally or legally. Then a lot of resources come late in the game. I argue for early intervention.
Does this affect all people equally, doctor, or is it... does it spread equally across gender, race, what have you?
Not necessarily. I think clearly the data would argue that key diagnoses like schizophrenia, major depressive disorder, in general, left to their own devices, occur equally across races and gender. Unfortunately, the stressors in American life are worse on people who are poor, lower SES, less resources, less education, poor housing. Because of that, the stressor-induced enhancement, more depression, more anxiety, more problems, leads to more psychiatric difficulty in people who have, I think, less resources.
Is there one type of mental illness that's more prevalent than others?
Oh, absolutely. I think clearly anxiety disorders are the most common. Up to a third of people meet criteria for a major anxiety disorder, panic attacks, or generalized anxiety disorder at some point in their career. But what we see the most is major depression. About 5% or 1 in 20 persons at some point meet criteria. If the stressors in their life make it worse, and if you don't have the resources around you, the cocoon of support, family or church or ability to go to a doctor for help, it gets worse. And very often our experience has been that's what leads to more practical difficulty.
Speak, if you will, about diagnosis and physiological as opposed to, I guess, psychological problems, if that be the way to put it, doctor. I guess what I'm trying to get at, how do you know what needs medication, what doesn't?
Well said. Clearly, I think for us, we identify stressors that may last 30 days or less as adjustment disorders don't need medication. So most people in society recognize that if you have a death in a family or if you lose your job, you'll feel bad for a certain point of time. That doesn't really require a level, I think, of psychopharmacological or medical intervention. But when things last longer than 30 days, it's a problem and we should intervene. When it lasts longer than 6 weeks, 6 months, it's a chronic problem, and you need long-term, probably 2 years of care, combinations of talk therapy, maybe group therapy if you have Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, and medications.
Is any of this hereditary?
Oh, absolutely. There's huge genetic loading in this regard, just like some people have, like me, more high blood pressure. Some have families with more stroke or diabetes and the like. Some people have family histories that put them at a greater risk of major depression disorder or the psychiatric illness.
I've been honest with the audience, doctor. I've suffered with depression all my life. I take medicine for it. It's a battle, man, I'm telling you. And for people that don't understand, it's not a matter of feeling blue or just cheer up. It's a lot deeper than that. I don't know exactly what's wrong, but something, I guess, is wrong with my brain, right, that's causing it?
Absolutely. I'd say two things. One, I cannot thank you enough for being the public figure you are and coming out and saying that, because one of our struggles, my whole 33-year career, one of the problems has been because of stigma. Many people accept having a high blood pressure or diabetes or an asthma, but they don't accept having a brain illness. These issues are real. the neurobiological, and I love the way you put it. Something actually is wrong or was different. Now, what I say to the audience is what's different is that there's neurochemicals in the brain, serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, epinephrine, and when they're out of balance, there's not enough where it's supposed to be in the brain, what's called a synapse, then people are a lot more likely to have clinical depression. Just like if your body doesn't make enough insulin, you're more likely to get diabetes. It's exactly the same physiological problem.
It seems to me, Doc, a big hurdle to get over is people need to realize that the brain is an organ, as is the lung or the kidney or the liver, right? And just as you would treat a problem with the liver or the kidney, there's no stigma, there's no shame in treating a disorder with the brain. You're not ashamed because you have liver trouble, right? I mean, that's crazy.
I agree. I think that the brain is an organ, just like the heart, the liver, and the kidney, if you will, and sometimes things go wrong. What I've often said in my career to patients is, when individuals get older, my mother's age 82, love her dearly, doing very well, long-term retired school teacher, but her brain just doesn't work as well at age 82 as it did when she was 30 years ago or 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. People get it as you're older. They call it being senile dementia. Senile just means age. It's the dementia that's the problem. And dementia can happen when you age 82 because of age. It can also happen when you're old, when you're younger. And when the dementia happens and the brain doesn't work as well as it normally should, you're going to have behavioral and cognitive and thinking and talking-related problems.
I just realized I probably shouldn't have said that's crazy. I could have picked my words better, but you know what I mean, right?
I do, and I don't struggle with it. I think the reality is it's a term that lay people tend to use, but we try to, as best we can, have an ongoing talking relationship with families, because families can go a long way toward not allowing stigma to block somebody who needs care from getting it. They can take them to the doctor and make sure they get care. Families can also say positive things around a dinner table, so if we give medicines to a person, they'll take it. They won't stop taking it because of fear. One of our struggles in my whole career has been, we're the specialty in medicine most likely for patients to go to the doctor or psychiatrist, get care, get treatment, and a lot of people go to the primary care doctor, not just psychiatrist, and I support that, but they never take the medicine the first time after getting a prescription filled. That's because of stigma. So many people who could be treated better and could function better in life don't do it because of stigma. We should actually argue against that.
How do you overcome that stigma?
I think three things. One, we have to have education. Programs like what you're doing today, I think, very, very helpful. I think it's two, people who you believe in and trust have to say that it's a good, normal thing, as you did in your own personal life. I've learned in my life, one of the big issues is religion. I'm from the South. I'm from Beaumont, Texas. Very proud of it. Happy to be here in Louisiana. I'm a new guy here. But when pastors and churches and priests and Catholic churches alike make positive comments about getting your mental health care, just like your diabetes care, your hypertension care, it decreases the stigma or the fear that people have that they can't be right with religion and be right with their doctor. That goes a long way, I think, toward helping support persons who need care to get it.
What about parents and kids? You know, I can remember back in the day, parents telling kids, if you don't straighten out, I'm going to take you to the insane asylum. And I'm serious. Parents would tell kids that. It seems like that maybe then, you know, times change. And thankfully, what's the best way for parents to handle a child if they think there's any type of, or what are some of the signs? How does a parent know if what their child is going through is serious or just, you know, we all go through changes and it's tough to adapt to change, none more so than when your body's growing and your personality's changing and so forth. How do you even begin that, doctor, to decide whether your child has a mental health problem or not?
I think you make a timely point. I think the parents, we should talk to our children. I have three kids myself. They're grown, but at different points in their life, they needed to be, we should talk about it. I should create a good environment for them to tell me what their problems are and the like. Sometimes they'll say more, sometimes they'll say less. But as a parent, we should be in tune to our children and what's kind of going on in their lives. Secondly, when a child does something that's acting out, they may be reaching out for help, rather than overly punitive in our response, we should realize maybe they're violating curfew or breaking some rules or breaking a window, whatever the case may be, and we should find out what's really bothering them and hear the story. I often say I'm a forensic doctor by training, and all too often in my career, you talk to somebody, a judge sends you to assess them, they've done a bad thing. They've done a crime or an assault or something violent, and it's unfortunate you've got to discuss those things, and that has to be managed in an appropriate legal way. But rarely have I had that experience, and later when talking to that kid, not get them to tell me what's their story. They were abused, and their mother died, and they had to move, and the Hurricane Katrina happened, and the like. And those stories of what's happened to them early on in life emotionally creates a long history of problems that then they act out about. We should see the acting out, and we got to address it, of course, but we got to also hear the story and try to allow them to tell us what's really bothering them. If we don't do that, the problem will just kind of continue repetitively, and sometimes could even lead to aggression or violence.
Did any of us that were here for Katrina escape unscathed?
I don't think so. I think people discuss after the unfortunate situation of the 20, you know, beautiful young children in Connecticut who were killed, you know, many years ago, that entire community now is diagnosed with a community PTSD. I think if any community in any city should be diagnosed with a citywide PTSD, it has to be New Orleans. The loss of whether it's 1,000 or 3,000 lives, $100 billion in damage, almost everybody was adversely impacted. If you came through unscathed and nobody died in your family, your house wasn't underwater, you couldn't go to your business, you couldn't work your job, and you had to move. So everybody was unfortunately impacted, right? Everybody was impacted, and we're paying the consequences a decade or two later. Society's still trying to catch up. These emotional harms don't just go away overnight.
For somebody that's listening right now and they think they're over Katrina, but they're not, I guess there would be people listening like that, Doctor, because I freely admit that all of a sudden your world was turned upside down completely, right? And you didn't know if you had a job. You didn't know if you were going to go back, if the city was going to come back. I guess there are some people that just did eventually with time get through it, but there are still some others that might be suffering.
Oh, absolutely. I have a young doctor that works for me here now, some of whom had to move and live in Tennessee or Alabama for not just weeks and months, but months and years, and kids that go to different schools, and it uprooted people's entire lives. That doesn't go away, I think, overnight. It also, I think, leads to this problem of one feeling vulnerable going forward. Every time you hear about a tragedy, it was a tornado in Mississippi yesterday, You feel like it's going to adversely impact you. Your emotional vulnerability grows. So-called your zone of influence is wider, and I think that almost every time something potentially happens, your thoughts or your fear pulls you right back into what you thought emotionally when that occurred. That's very, very difficult and can lead to substantial psychiatric impairment.
I think my child was six at the time, and I remember it was like 3 weeks in a row or 3 years in a row where they had evacuations, and that's hard as a child to tell them, okay, take what you think you want to keep because it might not be here when you come back. And then explain to a 6- and 7- and 8-year-old why you have to leave, and you know that has to be tough on anybody.
Right, because one substantial issue that we as parents provide for our children, and as government provides for society, is safety and stability and consistency. A lot of that, I think, is lost when you have to uproot and leave. If you come back, if all things are not really there, the folks then try to move and live in some different place that's safer. When you begin to believe that there's a lack of safety exists, I think that the worsened fears of these anxiety disorders we talked about earlier are substantial. Many folks with panic attacks, they occur intermittently. They're surprising. They're impulsive. They occur when you least expect them. But some trigger has happened that makes it occur in your life. That's a piece your audience should be mindful of. That trigger may be happening to you or your family. You think it's something that's occurring right now, but it may have a link to what happened a long time ago, including the Hurricane Katrina.
All right, let me take a break. Doc, we'll pick it up here when we come back, talking to Dr. Ron Bailey, Professor Chair of Psychiatry at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine, about mental health. From depression for most of my life. A lot of creative types do. I got treatment for it, and I take medicine for it, and it helps every day, and I hate to think what would happen if I didn't take the medicine. Some of the texts that are coming in, good morning, Tommy, great topic. I'm a psychotherapist in the area, and I can tell you that even the industry does not teach or treat mental health the same as physical health. There is talk of our diagnostic manual entering into the health diagnostic manual, but it's been talked for years. That's something I want to talk to the doctor about when we come back. Somebody else texted in and said the trouble is, endemically, our society has made light of mental issues. You're seen as being weak if you suffer from mental issues that you can't handle yourself. And I don't, that's why I'm not ashamed to talk about it, because something's wrong with my brain. It got to be fixed. And somebody else texted, try dialysis for 3 years, depression, that there is no other options. And we'll talk about the combination between a different physical illness and mental health as well. If you have any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. Somebody else texted about the difference between panic attacks and anxiety attacks. There is a difference. We'll talk about that with Dr. Ron Bailey, Professor Chair of Psychiatry at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. When we come back, 921, Tommy Tucker, WWL. 927, talking to Dr. Ron Bailey, Professor and Chair of Psychiatry at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine, about the mental health crisis in Louisiana, in America rather, in Louisiana as well, and our mental health issues taken as seriously as physical health ones. I got a text that comes in. And it says, Tommy, thanks for sharing your personal behavioral health medical challenges. Behavioral health care, same as dental health care, is simply that, health care. And I think that's a good point. Doctor, somebody texted in about the psychotherapist in the area and diagnostic manual entering the health diagnostic manual. What does that mean?
Right. So going back 50, 60 years, we've tried to make very uniform diagnosis so it wouldn't be willy-nilly and folks just kind of grabbing things out of the air. I think it started in the 1950s or 60s. Mm-hmm. So we have this book. It's the DSM, or the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. So we try to use data to argue what do you really have to have, what symptoms to meet the criteria for a certain diagnosis, so it's more authentic and more uniform. But we fought in psychiatry for years to make sure that our diagnoses are actually in the book correctly. And then there's a bigger book, was called ICD-10, International Clinical Diagnostic Book. And we, in psychiatry, we've had to kind of ensure we are viewed normally correctly. All those things ensure, A, that there's credibility and validity to the psychiatric diagnosis. Also that I think professionals like the therapists who wrote in can be paid, I think, fairly and equitably for the services. If you don't pay people well, then they won't do it. If they don't do it, society, I think, suffers. So it's been a big effort throughout the entirety of my career to make much more authentic our diagnostic patterns.
Somebody texted about loneliness. How big of a problem is loneliness?
I think it's huge. I think we live in a world, increasingly now, over the course of my career, I've seen it grow. Mm-hmm. Now you can sit in your own house and close the door and never come outside. You have the internet and you have information and you have various forms of social media. Many people tend to think, I believe, that they are more connected than they really are. Then when they walk out in the real world to go to a restaurant or to the mall or to a movie, they're pretty disconnected from other people, and it's a huge struggle. Our data makes it very clear that if you're disconnected, the risk of isolation and loneliness enhances the likelihood of clinical depression.
Somebody texted in and said they live alone and can't remember the last time they were hugged by anybody. How important is that, like basic physical interaction? Just, you know, like a hug or
anything? Essential. And my heart goes out to that person because we have physiological data that when somebody hugs you, you release oxytocin. It's a chemical that actually occurs with the intimacy of touch. People think of intimacy in regards to, you know, in a marital setting, but just in a regular friendly relationship, when you and somebody at church on Sunday or when you with a friend you went to school with years ago, you don't just have a handshake but a hug, it really matters. And we all, I think that psychologically it sends a signal that you're normal. If people get close to you and they won't touch or shake your hand, many of us feel that we put back a little bit. Is something wrong with me? Am I not managing my social graces well? So elements of touch go a long way, I think, toward making a person feel the human side of interpersonal engagement.
What about the difference between panic attacks and anxiety attacks, and how do you know which is which?
Right, so anxiety is our diagnosis for when the brain can't calm things down enough because the brain is moving all the time. At times you want it to go too faster than usual if you're driving fast, or if you don't want a snake, you want to be on high alert, you know, fight or flight. Other times you want the brain to kind of slow down so you can sleep at night or relax or calm down. And this ebb and flow of up and down, I think, matters. Panic attacks occur when there's this episodic burst of energy and activity. They may occur when they really shouldn't occur. If you're driving a vehicle and you're afraid of driving, man, you have a panic attack and all of a sudden you're nervous and you're sweating and your hands are trembling and like. That could occur in other settings, with public speaking, for example, or things of that nature. So a panic attack is abnormal. I mean, it's pathological. It's a diagnosis. It shouldn't happen. We actually treat that with medications. Everybody's heard of Xanax is a good example. We also treat it without a medication if you breathe into a paper bag. When you breathe back in the carbon monoxide that you breathe out, carbon dioxide, you're likely to decrease, I think, the anxiety-laden panic attack.
I know one thing that's helped me is when I get myself all freaked out over something, I'll stop and I'll start thinking, all right, let's go back now. Let's trace our steps. Let's see how we got here from where we were. And inevitably, it's not about what I'm freaking out about. It's something else. So I guess that's important to kind of be able to analyze yourself a little bit.
Well said. To the story I mentioned earlier, that very often there's a story behind the problem that we actually quash or kind of put aside. If my father died years ago, it may still be bothering me more than I realize now. Mm-hmm. If I lost a job or had to drop out of school or some people have an arrest on their record or whatever, these things don't necessarily emotionally and psychologically just kind of go away. We think that the brain is remarkably effective at kind of keeping them in forbearance, and over time what tends to happen is it pops up at the time it's you least expect it, and it knocks you back, I think, on your heels. So clearly, I think finding ways to deal with the stresses and the problems of life now go a long way toward decreasing the risk that later on there'll be psychological, you know, baggage for you that's hard to overcome. Often that's what leads to anxiety disorders.
Caregivers for parents, and I got a text and went through that, and oftentimes guilt can be an offshoot of that, where, you know, the whole thing is flip-flop, where the parent becomes a child becomes a parent. it can be exhausting dealing with a parent that has dementia. Keeping your patience, it's only natural that not every day is going to be happy and joyful. You're doing your best, but how does somebody go about dealing with maybe guilt that they should have been nicer, could have been nicer, weren't nicer?
Well said. I think we all need to be as nice as we can because these issues don't tend to just go away. And you're right. I think that when somebody gets older, I've already mentioned I have an 82-year-old mother. I'm an only child. As I try to kind of care for her, we both are very reflective of things that happened, you know, many years ago. Many good, but some, you know, that could be better. So right now we should all try to do that job better and for us being nice to people because, of course, these issues don't just go away. But we also, I think, do have some capacity to manage the past. We should talk about it. We should be earnest, I think, and honest in our discussion. Many make mistakes in interpersonal relationships with our parents or our siblings or what have you. I'm a strong believer that there's no time better than the present to try to clear the air, hear somebody's perspective. Some people don't need anything but an active voice, a chance to tell you what they think or they feel. Maybe they want to apologize. Maybe they hope you apologize to them. And we can maybe put past some of this emotional baggage that very often tends to hold families down.
Doctor, I appreciate your time. I really do. Any final thoughts?
No, I just want to thank you very much. I think these educational programs are essential. I think families and your audience listen to them, and they matter. We appreciate you for giving psychiatry a voice. So thank you.
Thank you, sir. Have a good day. Dr. Ron Bailey, professor and chair of psychiatry at LSU Health New Orleans School of Medicine. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Mike DeTillier. You lighten up a little bit. The Saints' win total is at 9.5, but wait. At 9.5, they got him winning the NFC South. Everybody else predicted at 7.5. We'll talk to Mike DeTillier about that, about LSU spring football practice, the LSU Tigers losing a defensive line coach, and more when we come back. I'll ask you at 504-260-1870, the Oakland Heart Jeweler Talk and Text Line. What do you think? 9.5. Are you taking the over and the or the under on the Saints' total wins for next year? Traffic now, WWL.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.